The epistle reading comes from the letter to the Ephesians, chapter 5, verses 6 through 14. Listen closely for the word of the Lord. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes on those who are disobedient. Therefore, do not be associated with them. For once you were darkness, but now in the Lord you are light. Live as children of light. For the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. Try to find out what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to mention what such people do secretly. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible. For everything that becomes visible is light. And therefore it says, "Sleeper, awake. Rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Well, old Jimmy is shuffling up the aisle again, and the organ is playing soft, sustained tones, beckoning anyone that might wish to make a change in their lives to come forward. And the pastor, who happened to be my dad, is standing at the front of the church, his eyes scanning the room expectantly. Is there anyone in the room today who might feel called to give their lives to Jesus? He would ask a variation on that question week after week, opening the doors to that dramatic moment that we call an altar call, an invitation to come forward and begin the life of faith. That is a staple of the evangelical worship service, and it gives a lot of us mainline folks the willies, I know. Honestly, it gave me the willies even then for reasons that I couldn't fully articulate. I was sitting up in the balcony, a jaded preacher's kid, pulled into worship week after week, whether I wanted to be there or not, polished and presented to the congregation as a member of this special family. It's not an easy thing, okay, being a preacher's kid. I found myself wanting to be anywhere else just on principle, even if I was enjoying myself. And I confess that I found myself on occasion wishing that things would go wrong in the worship service. I mean, yes, I have worked on this a little bit in therapy, but I imagined organ pipes falling off the walls or maybe some kind of rodent causing a stampede in the choir loft. It was a very, very minor form of rebellion. Some kids were experimenting with sex and drugs, but I was just imagining bad worship services. But then when it came time for the altar call, or the invitation, as we called it, I just kept my eyes fixed on this man, Jimmy. He was an old man in a shabby, ill-fitting suit, and he wore a toupee that was cocked at an awkward angle on his head. And he walked with a plastic cane, and he spoke with an odd gargle. And I now understand him to be a senior citizen with a developmental disability. But when I was a kid, he was just Jimmy, the man with the power to destabilize any worship service. He was my patron saint of church disruption. And if there was one thing that Jimmy loved, it was to respond to an altar call. If there was an invitation, Jimmy would accept it. He would lumber up to his feet and shuffle down the aisle while the congregation sang something like, "Just as I am." And he would make his way to the front, and I would scan my father's face, seeking signs of weariness or frustration. But if he was feeling it, he didn't show it. He had the poker face of a veteran card shark. And Jimmy would take my father by the arm and lean his face in very close and say something like, "I've decided that I would like to give my life to Jesus." And my dad would give him a warm embrace and ask him to sit on the front row, and it happened more weeks than not, and I lived for it. It got to the point where if Jimmy did not rededicate his life to Christ one Sunday, we all wondered what he was up to. And it wasn't just the saboteur in me that loved Jimmy's weekly ritual. He was breaking the rules. The whole idea of a dramatic conversion experience is that you build up to it, and then you finally break down, and you say yes to God, and then God transforms your life. It's a once-in-a-lifetime moment that some churches have done a very good job of fetishizing. But there was something very human inside of Jimmy that said yes whenever the question was asked. And I would like to think that I was not just a jerk amused by a man with a disability. I would like to think that I saw something subversive and holy in Jimmy's weekly shuffle up the aisle. This is the second week of our sermon series about Christianity and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And each week we are taking two more steps of Bill W.'s cherished sequence, asking ourselves what wisdom might be found there, not just for people in recovery, but for all of us. And last week, Andrew laid the groundwork for us, taking on the enormous first and second steps. Number one, admitting that we are powerless before addiction. And number two, coming to believe that there is a power greater than us that could restore us to sanity. And the case that we are making may seem self-evident to some of you and outrageous to others. We are making the case that we are all addicts. We are all addicted in one way or another. And that's a very loaded word, addict. It conjures up very specific images of people you see or people you love or people you hate. It's not a word that anyone cares to apply to him or herself, which is why owning the addiction is step one. It is foundational to the process. And Webster's defines the word addict in surprisingly religious terms, to devote or surrender oneself habitually or obsessively to something. And while addiction can look like a devoted, dogged attention to something, Richard Rohr makes the case in his book, Breathing Underwater, that it is also often a consummate form of distraction, minimizing other uncomfortable realities we would just as soon ignore. I was using alcohol to treat my alcoholism, someone told me earlier this week. It was really just a powerful anesthesia against other painful things I would rather not consider. And when one can, of course, be addicted to all kinds of things, but one thing that nearly all of us are addicted to is a false understanding of ourself. Rohr would argue that there is a very human instinct to build strategies for success. He calls them happiness programs that rely upon and affirm our own strength. In short, we create false versions of ourselves that have everything they need to navigate the world. And we invest an incredible amount of time and energy and money into maintaining that narrative. And it can look like gym memberships or virtue signaling or wealth and class signifiers or plastic surgery. It can look like tiny little lies that move you to the center of your own story. You said the funny thing, not the lady next to you. You saw the car accident instead of hearing about it on the news. You. The tiny adjustments we make to keep our fragile egos intact. Or maybe that's just me. I mean, I do know that it is me. I am a preacher, for God's sake, so I think I know a thing or two about embellishment. And here's the paradox. It is frequently the most successful members of our culture who are the least aware of their addictive natures, the deep investment they have in the illusion of their ability to handle any challenge. People who have moved from seeming success to seeming success seldom seem to understand success at all, says Rohr, except for a very limited version of their own. I think that Rohr's words are a helpful lens through which to understand Jesus' teaching that if anyone wants to become my follower, let them deny themselves, take up their cross daily, and follow me. There are plenty of readers, especially modern readers, who have found Jesus' endorsement of self-denial distasteful. Some people object on psychological grounds. Are we not supposed to love and accept ourselves? Some people object on feminist grounds, another man telling us to ignore our own interests. Some people object on capitalist grounds. Self-interest is the engine of our economy. And there may be elements of truth in all of those critiques, but I think they also are missing Jesus' point. Here is what I hear him saying. Let go of the illusion that you are going to be your own savior. Let go of the idea that you are the God of your own universe. And then, maybe even more gently, he is saying, look what you are doing to yourself in the process of maintaining that illusion. And look what you're doing to the people you love. This is a very costly self-deception. Yesterday, a friend who has been in recovery for many years took me with her to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the brightly colored Sunday school classroom of a local church. And the group moves through the 12 steps in sequence, and yesterday's meeting was focused on the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. And it was, for me, in the eyes of a newcomer, an absolutely eye-opening experience, because person after person introduced themselves by saying their first name, followed quickly by, "And I am an alcoholic." And they shared the frankly horrific details of their descent into addiction. And then they proceeded to share their thoughts on turning their lives over to God in a manner that I have honestly never heard before. Because what was so interesting to me is that almost without exception, each speaker agreed that the God as we understand God section of the third step was far less important than the made a decision to turn my life over part of the third step. And there were very diverse understandings of who God is. There were two Orthodox Christians, a Catholic, a cheerful atheist, one person who just said, "I believe in love, and if it is true that God is love, then I believe in God." And what do all these people share in common? They get on their knees every day, and they pray, literally out loud, to the God of their understanding, and they ask that God to help them relinquish control over their own lives so that they will be able to be sober for another day. And they do it because they must do it if they want to survive, and they do it because it works. And don't get me wrong, I do think it matters quite a lot what we believe about God or who we understand God to be, but we have spent a lot of time arguing about that. We have spent a lot of time kicking people out of the church over that. We've spent a lot of time removing ourselves from communities over that. And what I observed yesterday was a group of people who don't have time for that. So they are walking the talk, and they are following God, and they are being saved. And when the meeting concluded, we held hands in a circle. "Keep coming back. It works if you work it," the group said in unison. "Those who want to save their lives will lose it," Jesus said, "and those who lose their life for my sake will save it." Step four. If step three didn't manage to push your buttons, then perhaps step four will take care of it. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. The searching and fearless moral inventory is exactly what it sounds like. You sit down with a piece of paper and you write down all of your flaws and defects. You take your time with it and you try to name them all. And I have been told you are also welcome to name the lovely aspects of yourself as well, although that is usually not the difficult part. And it will not surprise you that some people get a little hung up on step four. People get a little hung up on steps one, two, three, and four because they are nothing short of a full-on assault on our false understanding of ourself. It will probably also not surprise you that people who have spent time in strict religious environments have a hard time with step four because we are tired of judging ourselves. We are tired of being judged. We have been judged and wounded and stereotyped and shamed and put down and rejected, and we are done with that. Especially when it's done by snooty church people who wouldn't know a good time if it smacked them across the face. And to all of that understandable defensiveness, Richard Rohr wisely says, take a deep breath. Moral scrutiny is not to discover how bad or good I am or how to regain some moral high ground, he writes, but it is to begin some honest shadow boxing, which is at the heart of all spiritual awakening. Yes, the truth will set you free, as Jesus says, but first, it tends to make you miserable. The fearless and searching moral inventory is about stepping from darkness into light. You may not like what you see, but there is no other way forward. There is, of course, other, more churchy language for the moral inventory. It is called the confession of sin. The 12 steps are very careful to avoid such terminology, as it is very loaded for some folks, but if you are serious about following Jesus, then you are probably in a tradition that takes telling the truth about sin seriously. We see it in the letter to the Ephesians, our second scripture reading. The letter was not written to any specific congregation, but rather passed around like a newsletter meant to exhort and encourage churches all across Asia Minor. Once you were in the darkness, the author says, once you were darkness, but now in the Lord you are light. Live as children of the light. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them, it says in verse 11. And then comes this very interesting construction. Everything exposed by the light becomes visible, for everything that becomes visible is light. I really love that, even if it doesn't totally make sense. Everything exposed by the light becomes visible. That's fairly straightforward. If you want to see something for what it is, you turn on the light. Even if you don't want to see something for what it is, if you turn on the light, you will see it. Everything becomes visible. The second part is less obvious, though. Everything that becomes visible is light. It's not hard to think of instances where that is not true. Terrible things come to light every day. Just consult the Baltimore Sun. I think that what the text is getting at, though, is that becoming visible is an inherent part of the healing process. Becoming visible, being brought out into the light, is a step that cannot be skipped. Your moral imagination is vitamin D deficient. The spirit does not live in the shadows. If you read the entire letter of Ephesians, you will notice some of the content that gives the Bible a bad reputation. I'm talking about the wives submit to your husband's stuff and the slaves obey your master's stuff. And it's tempting not to mention that because the part we're looking at today is so good. But honestly, look at what has happened over the centuries. The inherent racism, sexism, exploitation in the text, it has come to the light because we know more than we used to. Because we see more than we used to, because we are being healed. The shadow boxing is a never-ending process, even in the cultures that birthed our sacred texts. When you come to a place of trust, a place of understanding the moral inventory, you begin to understand that the moral inventory is not meant to shame, but to heal. And then the shadows themselves become less frightening. We can learn to not be afraid of the dark. To say that this is hard work is an understatement, but it is happening in churches all across this country, maybe in the sanctuary, if the congregation is so lucky, but almost certainly in the basement and in the Sunday school room, in and amongst coffee cups and cigarette butts and laminated copies of the 12 steps and 12 traditions. Keep coming back. It works if you work it. Everything that becomes visible is light. Is it not true that we return again and again to our childhood memories over time, discovering and seeing more than we once thought was possible? Why was I so amused by old Jimmy? Why did I think about him more than many other people in the church? And why did I love him more than I understood? It's true, I guess, that I loved him for exposing what my teenage brain saw as the flaws and melodrama of the very idea of an altar call. At its very worst, I found it emotionally manipulative and built around the idea of a conversion experience that I did not believe in. And so, every time Jimmy lumbered to his feet, making his way forward with that embarrassing shuffle to take my father's arm, I thought, see, that's the kind of man who needs an altar call. Not just once, but every week. A weak man. A man who fails to understand the world. It would take me an embarrassingly long time to understand that Jimmy also possessed a deep and gifted spirit, unencumbered by the fear that keeps so many of us tethered to the insane idea that we will save ourselves. What so many of us accept only after an enormous amount of resistance and, yes, suffering, was something that Jimmy knew intuitively. And when he died a few years back, I felt a wave of grief that I guess should not have surprised me. But I also knew and know without a doubt that he is with Jesus. Of course he is, because that is the only place that he was ever going. I've decided I would like to give my life to Jesus, he would whisper too close to your face. Me too, Jimmy, me too, I say to myself these days. And one day, when I can summon up your courage, I will,